Pennsylvania when I was a lad. Our castle was cold, yet we never were sad. We learned to be happy, we danced round the hall, and learning to count was the key to it all. By counting each count, I knew just where to start, and one special step stayed close to my heart.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talk back program.
Twirl round the floor, 1, 2, 3, left foot you swing, 1, 2, 3, then start to sing, 1, 2, 3, loud as you raise, 1, 2, 3, counting with 1, 2, 3, doing the patty pat.
Ha, 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 ha. I used to love the count, folks. And you know what? We were talking earlier in the show today about the hilarious House of Frightenstein. I'm not sure how much that program got down in the United States, but it was a huge hit up here in Canada. And, of course, the Dracula on that show, or the vampire, or whatever he was. It was good. It was fun. But many of you have a hard time with vampire stuff these days. Should we believe it? Do we not believe it? Is it really real? Are there such a thing? Folklore, mister? Is it just people that like to drink blood and then they go to rave parties at late at night and put lots of white and black makeup on? What is the go here? Well, Dr. J. Gordon Melton joins us. He is the world's leading vampire scholar. As the director of the Institute for the Study of American Religion, Dr. Melton is the author of more than 25 books, including several encyclopedias, handbooks, and almanacs. Wait, let's hear the count one more time, just in the middle of his bio.
We try again!
It almost sounds like a bar mitzvah.
Really?
Okay, sorry, I just a little ADD moment there.
He's a kosher vampire.
He's a kosher vampire, that's right. I mean, he's written on new religious movements, occultism and parapsychology, new age and vampirology. Dr. Melton has researched the history of vampires as well as the study of contemporary vampiric groups and rites. In 1983, he served as the editor for Vampires on Earth, first comprehensive bibliography of English-based vampire literature. In 1994, he completed the Vampire Book, an Encyclopedia of the Undead, which is also sort of a family photo album for me, and has also written The Vampire Gallery, A Who's Who of the Undead. And he joins us right now. Dr. Melton, thank you for your time.
Oh, good to be here.
What have I taken you away from? You were doing some kind of research, were you? Were you handing out candy?
Well, we are here. It's still morning. And I have been working this morning on the new edition of my vampire book, which will be out next year.
All right. What's this new edition called? Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, it's going to be the third edition of the vampire book, The Encyclopedia of the Undead. And it attempts to be a comprehensive book about the whole phenomena of vampires and a few things related to it, like incubi and the like.
So you needed another edition because the first one sucked?
it did, but then we revamped it with the second edition, and now we're moving on.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I got to apologize for that right off the bat. Well, yeah. here's how you've been described by the L.A. Times. Melton, now this would be back in, I think, 97 when you had the big Dracula fest or whatever it was down there. So this is a few years ago. A bearded Methodist minister who delivers occasional Sunday sermons at St. Mark's Church in Santa Barbara, also works as a researcher in religions at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and has written a dozen books on religion, plus two on vampires. Is that really you? Are you a bearded Methodist minister who delivers occasional Sunday sermons at St. Mark's Church in Santa Barbara?
Well, I do have a mustache and goatee. I do attend St. Mark Methodist Church here in Santa Barbara, and then they do let me preach every once in a while. I'm still a member of the conference. I've been on what the Methodists call special appointment for these last 20 years. And so I don't preach regularly, but I preach and teach Sunday school as they see fit.
You would be a very cool Sunday school teacher. I think that would be phenomenal to have you. But see, here's the brain twist in people's minds is how can you be the Jesus guy and be a vampire specialist? There's something wrong with that equation.
Well, not really. I mean, we all have, within the Christian community, we have scholars who study all kinds of things outside the Christian community, from other religions to different kinds of crime, or to the things people do that are not particularly Christian in order to understand those kinds of things.
But, Gordon, you dressed up and maybe still do as a vampire.
Oh, every once in a while. I'm getting a little too old to do that anymore, but we all have a little Halloween within us.
Well, see, but that's, you know, you've heard the pushback on this. You've heard the Christian right or the evangelical fundamentalist folks or the good Southern Baptists or the happy clappy Pentecostals. They've sort of said, come on, if you dress up as a vampire, you are encouraging demonic activity.
Well, since I don't believe that vampires are real, it's all a kind of a fantasy life. It's certainly no more dangerous than dressing up as anything else on Halloween.
Like Benny Hinn.
Yes.
Yeah. That was going to be my outfit this year, but I couldn't find enough hair. Okay, so you've answered the first key question, which is, you know, you are a vampire specialist who doesn't believe in vampires.
Right. The vampires are pretty much, they're a product of folklore from the days when we needed various kinds of folklore myths to explain things we now explain with scientific myth. And we then transferred the vampire to the stage and to the novel and other forms of literary entertainment in the beginning of the 19th century. And since that time, you know, the idea has continued to grow. It's an important phenomena simply because of the extent to which the vampire, the modern vampire myth, the literary myth, has permeated our culture so much. And it becomes important for us to understand what's going on here that so many people would get turned on by the vampire.
Well, a number of years ago, was it called Dracula Fest or something? What was that thing in
LA? Oh, Dracula 97.
97,
right. That was the 100th anniversary of the publication of the Dracula novel by Bram Stoker.
Okay. And so in 97, we were still saying the same thing, that Dracula and interest in vampires is permeating our culture at such a rate that we need to have a good hard look at this. So that was in 97. Now it's 2009, almost 10, and we're saying the same thing. So is it really growing the interest in vampires and Dracula and whatever? Or is it just something that each generation says, wow, there certainly seems to be a lot of fascination?
Well, we've been able to do some measuring of it. Since 1997, the number of vampire books, novels, has doubled. That is, from 1800 to 97, the number of vampire novels is equal to the number of vampire novels published in the decade since.
Wow. Okay, hold on. I got to make sure I just heard that right. Are you saying that from the 1800s to 1997... the number of vampire novels or books or literature, whatever, it was one number, and then from 97 till now, that number has doubled in 10 or so years?
Yes.
Wow.
It's almost true of movies. It's about, there were about 1,000 vampire movies that had been made up to 97, and about 800 more have been made since 97.
Would you say that there is a correlation between that and the sexualization of our culture?
That's certainly part of it. Part of it is actually the growth in population, the actual number of people out there who read books and the number of people who watch movies has grown as the population has grown.
Right.
So some of it is that, but there are a number of different factors.
Well, yeah, every vampire we see on TV is sexy and cool.
Well, that was a change that occurs in the 70s, and the big expansion of vampire novels has been in the romance field.
Right.
So that there's this huge number. I've counted 70 romance writers, just in romance literature, 70 writers who are doing series of books on vampires, a series of vampire novels. So it's a growing phenomenon.
All right, let's talk about Anne Rice. I had her as a guest on my show last year, and boy, did we have a beautiful discussion. Her spiritual journey is fascinating. Her story, her story is fascinating, and of course, everyone knows Anne Rice as the. I mean, she is. Would you not say the number one vampire novelist?
Well, she certainly was through the 1990s. She's, you know, now been replaced by Laurel Hamilton and now by Stephanie Meyer. Stephanie Meyer has actually, in the last few years, sold more books than Anne Rice.
Wow.
And so the Twilight series, the first Twilight movie is the second largest grossing vampire movie of all time and has only been out a year. And so it is, you know, Meyer has jumped ahead of Rice a little bit, but Rice was certainly the one who got this thing all started back in the 90s.
Okay, so let's see if we can get a clear and concise answer from Dr. J. Gordon Melton, otherwise known as our vampire specialist today. The reason vampires are so popular today is because...
They bring us face-to-face with three of our important wants: power, sexuality, immortality.
Oh, my God. I just wrote those three words down. Seriously. I'm sorry. That's a little spooky. What should I believe about that? Maybe I should ask the psychic later in the show what that means.
Right. Well, it's great minds run in the same direction.
Right. Okay. Have you read the new Dracula book by, is it Stoker's descendant, I think? A grandson, maybe?
I don't. I just got a copy and haven't had a chance to get into it yet. I was on a program with the two of them, the two co-authors, just a month or so, or a couple of weeks ago, actually. And got my copy, but I've been finishing up a big project otherwise and haven't had a chance to do much leisurely reading.
leisurely reading. You were the first one to tell me that you are not a Dracula specialist. There's someone actually in Toronto who would be considered the lead in that area.
Oh, I Elizabeth and I used to publish a journal together, which she has continued as her own, and Elizabeth is certainly the top Dracula expert in the world now.
What's her last name again?
Elizabeth Miller.
Miller, that's right. I was going to say Taylor, but that would be wrong.
Yeah, we've had Elizabeth is an English professor who has specialized in Dracula studies from a literary point of view. I'm a religion scholar who studies the whole vampire phenomena. So we have a somewhat different approach. We've done programs together and this kind of thing. And of course, she was the person who helped with the LA thing. She was on our steering committee when we put that together.
All right. So you mentioned that there are different camps of believers out there, much like, I guess, in the world of theology, we all land in different camps. How about in the world of vampires? How would you describe the different camps?
Well, the largest group of people are the people who go to vampire movies and read vampire novels. That, you know, when we talk about the 8 million copies of Interview with a Vampire that was sold, that's that big group who do those things. The smaller group are people who are, you know, think the vampire is so good, I'd like to be one. The wannabe community.
They're nuts, right?
Well, they're certainly misguided. They're interesting people, but they don't realize that the vampire they're trying to be is not even the folklore vampire. It is the literary vampire that was created in the 1820s on the stage in Paris, and that's one of the problems with that. There are a few people, and this is a very, very small community, who are into blood drinking, are into what we call psychic vampirism, and who believe themselves to be vampires. That's maybe a few thousand people in the Western world.
You know, here's a question I should have asked John Moorhead, but I'll ask you as well. When it comes to those people that really believe what they're believing, and they end up getting into spell casting, etc., should the Jesus people be afraid of spellcasters?
I don't believe spells work, but so I'm not afraid of them at all.
Right.
I don't believe that witches, either witches or the few vampires types who are into that kind of magic have the ability to affect any change anywhere.
So how can we take them seriously? I guess you're saying we shouldn't. We should not take the vampire crowd seriously. But yet, I mean, seriously, Gordon, here you are. Are you still considered the Count Dracula ambassador to the United States?
Well, not really. That organization has kind of gone the way of the world. I think we seriously take into consideration how thinking about vampires affect our culture and what it represents for us as human beings. We seriously take into consideration those people who think of themselves as vampires, and we try to understand what they're all about. The majority of those people fit into a kind of an esoteric world. The esoteric tradition is right now the second largest religious tradition in America. We think of the Jewish community as being about 5 to 6 million. We think of the esoteric community as slightly larger than that. And they are a small segment of that esoteric community. And as such, they have quite a body of theological literature behind them, though most of the spokespersons are not aware of that. And so for those, we take them seriously that way as representatives of another religious tradition.
Hmm.
In between, the wannabes, no, we don't take the wannabes seriously. we make jokes about them.
Can they make jokes about themselves, or are they just that far gone?
Some of them can, and
I mean, they're like Trekkies,
right? Well, these are one stage beyond Trekkies. Trekkies can make jokes about themselves. Trekkies understand what they're doing, and are very self conscious about their role playing. Among the wannabes are some who kind of wish it was real and can make jokes about themselves, but there are wannabes who are very, very, very serious. They take jobs at night. They sleep in a coffin. You know, they dress as what in goth styles, and they're not the major part of the goth community, but they dress in goth styles, and they really think that if they lead this life, that along the way they will encounter a real vampire and be able to become one.
Wow.
That's
nuts.
It seems to be a little psychologically pathological.
Yeah. Now, okay, I'm just going to stay with what I said. That's nuts. Okay, but here's the deal. It's easy to laugh at other groups, but when we look at what Christians believe, there's a lot of goofy stuff that we believe. So, you know, it's that whole saying, before you point the finger, look at the three pointing back at you. I don't want to ridicule too much a group of people that I really don't understand. And because what's behind all of this is a searching. They're still searching.
Yes.
And I believe that they're searching for a connection with the supernatural, much like the Christians have done or are doing. So I don't think we can laugh and put them down for that. Is there empathy we can find for these people?
Well, I think so. I think with that large group of people who just read vampire books and go to vampire movies, that for them, they understand that that's just entertainment, and they go about their life otherwise.
Right.
But for the people who seriously think of themselves as vampires already, most of them, follow a kind of a Gnostic religious outlook. They have an understanding of God that we could analyze in terms of Gnosticism and a belief system that works that way. And they have real experiences that we would think of as psychic experiences that undergird their belief.
Right.
So for them, we should take them very seriously, and I think, you know, we should be in dialogue with them and learn about them and be better prepared to offer. offer them the gospel when the opportunity arises.
But what do you say, Dr. Melton, when the Christian groups will say to you, or theologians, or, I don't know, the John MacArthurs of the world will say, set yourself apart from this lot, have nothing to do with them. And here you are saying, I think, intimating something like, you know, by the way, John Moorhead and I talked about someone we know in common, Ross Clifford from Australia. Do you know Ross?
I've met him.
Yeah, Ross was my alternative religious movements professor at Moreland College, and he was the first one who really encouraged us to engage the other cultures, in that esoteric group especially. And I've been taught for years to have nothing to do with them. Where's the happy medium, so to speak?
Well, I kind of take Jesus as my example and dine with sinners. I see Jesus moving about the world, not living alone in a, with this small separatist community. We let the Qumran community do that, but. The Christian life is a life lived out in the world, engaged in it, and that we come together at times and places as a Christian community to learn and refresh ourselves. And it's not the church on Sunday morning is not the center of our life. The church on Sunday morning is where we get charged up to go engage the world during the week. And that's kind of the way I look at it, as what we're supposed to be doing.
All right. Well, just before we say goodbye, the time is absolutely flown. I would love to have you on the show again. Unfortunately, we get bombarded with the nonsense out of Dr. James Beverly every once in a while, and I'm going to hold you responsible for that. Of course, you and Jim worked together quite closely many times, so Jim was actually the one that put me on to you, so you can blame him.
All right, well, I'll see him this week, so I'll do that.
Good. Can you just give us a quick synopsis or a brief overview of the historicity of vampires?
Well, vampire belief is...
Hold on. By the way, is there such a thing as historicity? Is that a real word?
Sort of. There are a number of variations on it, but
thanks.
Yes, that is real work.
It sounded good, so I thought I'd say it.
Vampires began, our first knowledge of vampires is in the first layer of written material we have from Greek culture in the Mediterranean 6,000 years ago. Vampires show up in not all, but most cultures around the world, and they have, you know, several functions of explaining life or explaining death, explaining odd births, crib death, what we call crib death now. They continue in culture in the 19th century. They begin their interaction with developing science. Folklore recedes from that point on, and the vampires hop to the stage in London in 1820. They are primarily a dramatic thing for European stage until late in the 19th century. Then you start getting the novels and a lot of poems, and then again they jump to the stage in the 1920s and then to the movies in the 30s, and they just grown ever since.
You know, I lied. I've got one more question. Mm-hmm. Who was the scariest vampire you've ever met? And I use vampire in quotes.
There's so many of them. I think the characters in the movie Near Dark were about as scary as any that I would ever want to encounter.
But what about in real life?
Oh, in real life?
Yeah. No, because you, I mean, dude, you, dude, I'm sorry, I just called you dude. Doctor, you've gone to vampire conventions. You must have come across one or two that just gave you the heebie-jeebies.
No, I can't say I have.
Really?
You know, in real life, I met some nasty people, but they weren't vampires.
No, they were probably faith healers. No, I'm kidding. Listen, it was great to chat with you. You've got a great personality, and I admire your work. It is quite a volume And Dr. J. Gordon Melton is who we've been chatting with. Is there a website we can point people to for you if they want to find out a little bit more? Or just go to Amazon and buy your books?
The best one is with my Italian colleague, Massimo Intravigne, who was also at Dracula 97. He keeps a pop culture site going, and most of my vampire stuff, apart from my books, have appeared on that site. It's Cesnur.org. CESNUR.org, and that would be the place to go.
Okay, all right, we've got it. Thank you very much. It was great to chat with you today, and then happy Halloween.
Likewise.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There you go, folks. That was our vampire specialist. He is more than he lets on to be. Yeah, he's a scholarly lad. He really is. Well, we're moving along in our Halloween special.
We are.
And it's time to move into our psychic portion of the show.
Yes, but that again, was predictable.
Then again, you knew that. Yes. Oh, she's a good girl. I wouldn't have invited her on if there's a lot of nuts out there, seriously, and a lot of arrogant people in the psychic world. And I did not pick that up with our next guest here at all. Quite looking forward to this. Some of you will think that I'm being a bad person by doing this, so you may want to just go away and tune in later when we have the international fraud buster on the show, James Randi. He's going to join us just around 4 o'clock or shortly after. He spent his life discrediting psychics and homeopaths and faith healers. So that'll be interesting. And then later in the show, we're going to talk about H1N1. We'll have a big fancy doctor guy on the show there as well. The big fancy doctor guy. I get to a point every show where I just don't care anymore, you know?
Yes.
So, Catherine Opashinov. Oh, my goodness. Here we go. Now we're going to really find out how to say her name.
Yes.
Opashinov, I think is how you say it. She is an intuitive, she is a psychic, and she'll be with us momentarily. Stay with us.